Welcome to the Sober Shaman Podcast, where we explore ways to make the spiritual practical and apply these medicines to the recovery from addiction and trauma. Today's guest is Dr. Brett Cordes. He is a recently retired ear, nose, and throat physician and surgeon who is now launching his own private physician coaching business. His career was almost completely derailed as he battled the disease of addiction. However, through consistently daily work, founded in humility, he was able to rejoin the career that he always loved. He is now coaching physicians with symptoms of burnout and substance abuse. I really enjoyed my talk with Dr. Brett. He helps physicians. I love this topic, and I love that there are people like him who can provide such a shortcut for this particular population that has so many particular situations involved, and he really cuts to the chase with it. Here's our talk. Dr. Brett Cordes, thank you very much for joining me here today on the Sober Shaman Podcast. I am very much looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And we can start in a number of different areas, but first, how about a little introduction to your story? One of the most obvious things is that you are in recovery from addiction as a doctor. And if you want to lean a little bit into that right off the bat, who knows where that'll lead us. But I'm very curious to hear your experience from losing the license. I hear you back into getting a license. It looks like there's going to be a lot here to go through. So please start wherever you like.
Okay. Well, I'll start way back at the beginning because, there's a certain number of things in my childhood that I experienced that help explain my journey into addiction, because I did not start using until I was 35. So, but I was born in Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Louisiana in the States, and pretty normal childhood, except that both of my parents were academicians. They both were professors at the local university. And my sister, who was 10 years older than me, she was number two in her high school graduating class, number one in her college and law school class. So the picture I'm trying to paint here is that kind of excellence was modeled for me from a very, very young age. Now, my parents never sat me down and told me anything less than an A is unacceptable. But I kind of misinterpreted their modeling of excellence. And I thought that I had to achieve, basically, in order to obtain their love. You know, they were just giving me praise when I did something well, but I misinterpreted that. And I felt like love was conditional on achievements and doing well and following the rules and stuff like that. So that later on in my story, that's going to catch up to me. But yeah, had a, like I said, normal childhood, played a lot of sports. I was always a good student, went to high school in Baton Rouge, went to college at LSU, which is the local university in Baton Rouge. I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do when I started college. You know, I'm 19 years old and I don't even know what major to pick. I know I like science and I knew I liked history. So I decided I'd major in history. I knew I did not want to be a lawyer like my sister. So I did know that. But I hadn't ruled out being a teacher because both my parents were teachers and I thought that could be a possibility. But so at the tail end of my freshman year, I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a cancer of the lymph nodes.
Wow.
And this experience in and of itself could be an entire podcast episode, but I'll just suffice it to say that it was marred by one recurrence of the disease and 16 total months of treatment from beginning to end. And ultimately, my treatment culminated in a stem cell transplant, which at the time was kind of a cutting edge treatment option.
Right.
But, you know, I learned a lot about myself during that experience, and there were many silver linings that I obtained from that experience. But one of the bigger ones is that it's what made me want to be a doctor. And so I stayed majoring in history, took all the science classes, and went to medical school just because of that experience. My experience as a patient and seeing medicine from a patient's side so intently for so long. So, so that's what shifted the course of my life at that point.
Boy, that'll do it. And how, you know, the way you say certain things about your misperception of parents' love, that's a one-liner that it's like, wait a minute, your whole childhood was a misperception of love. So I'm curious. I'd love to circle back around whenever you're ready to, when that misperception was made aware to you, and how then you went and, I don't like the word fix, but you know what I mean? Oh, that's interesting. You took that awareness and then applied it to wherever you were at that point in your life and your recovery. I assume that'll be coming up, but
it will.
What an interest.
Yes, it will.
It's interesting and heartbreaking and kind of common that there are these events in life, your cancer, that changed your whole direction. And you're saying it for the better in certain ways. It's a silver lining. So how did that silver lining and that interest and take us off from there?
So went to medical school in New Orleans, again, also in Louisiana, for those of listeners that aren't familiar. And then graduated medical school and went and trained in Houston, Texas, in the Texas Medical Center. And my specialty is ear, nose, and throat surgery. And so 5 years of residency there. And I do want to mention, because I forgot to mention this, during those 16 months of battling cancers when I was first introduced to opiates. And the interesting thing is that I didn't think much of them at the time. I mean, I remember describing them as like maybe a two beer buzz. That's what it felt like, but it wasn't anything to write home about. I didn't have any sort of euphoric feeling. It just kind of felt okay. And it never crossed my mind to take those pain pills when I wasn't in pain. Nor did it ever cross my mind to save, the pills when I didn't need them anymore. You know, I just threw them away. So anyone who has any experience with addiction or alcoholism would know that that's not how a typical addict would go about things. But again, I guess it wasn't in the cards for me at that age and at that time. But that is where I was initially exposed to opiates. This brings us to about 2009. I've done 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency training. So that's 13 years altogether before I really started working and earned my very first actual paycheck. I was 32 years old. Now, I cut grass when I was in high school and college for money, but, you know, that's a cash business and not really official. But I do like to remind myself that I was 32 years old before I earned my first paycheck. But it was phenomenal. You know, a lot of people ask me once you graduated residency and you were a full-blown doctor, was it everything you hoped it would be? Was it everything you dreamed it would be? And the answer was yes and then some, because it really was incredible. My life was incredible. My wife and I had two young, healthy kids. And started private practice in the Texas Medical Center, built up a very quickly thriving medical practice. And everything was going, you know, very well for a good 5 years. And around the 5-year mark, so this would be about 2014 or 2015, I started to feel what at the time I experienced as boredom. I started to feel bored. I felt like I was bored because I wasn't really getting stimulated in terms of new things at work. And remember, I had been, my entire life, I had been climbing this mountain to get to where I finally was. I mean, long before college, you know, getting good grades and this and that. And there's a lot of things that go into getting into medical school. And then, so I've been climbing this kind of competitive mountain for my entire life. And so you'd think that I'd kind of stop and smell the roses once I got there. But unfortunately, I remember thinking kind of, you know, well, what's next? What's the next challenge? And what I was looking for, and again, I didn't learn this until rehab, but what I was looking for was the dopamine hit that achievements used to give me. That's what was lacking. And that's what led to boredom, which kind of led to some depression and anxiety. So it all from a scientific standpoint, it all kind of comes back to lack of dopamine. But that's how we circle back to equating self-love with achievements and equating self-worth with accolades and achievements and things like that, as opposed to appreciating the fact that, you know, we have self-love regardless, and generally unconditional love from our parents. So, but yeah, that's the hurt. That's the void that I was trying to fill at that time in my life. Bing. So, question is, how did I start using opiates? You know, I'm 35 years old, and typically on like any random Friday afternoon, I would get off work early, sometime around 2:30, go home, and my wife and I would I'd have a couple of beers, she'd have a glass of wine, and we'd sit by the pool and just relax and talk about the week and talk about the upcoming weekend and the kids, and that was our routine. So on this random Friday afternoon, a drug rep had circled into the office and gave us a bunch of samples of a cough medicine that was hydrocodone based. And for the listeners that don't know, hydrocodone is what's in most pain pills. And my first thought was, oh, I know what that feels like. That feels like a couple of beers. So I made the decision to take one of those samples home. And instead of having a couple of beers, I just have one of these cough medicine samples, see how that goes. But this time it was just vastly different because I did have this just explosive, euphoric feeling that wasn't anything comparable to what I had felt before. It was the most euphoric, best, relaxed feeling I had ever felt in my life. And more importantly, that boredom, that anxiety, that depression vanished.
Poof.
And it was just, it was unbelievable. And again, from kind of a science physiotherapy standpoint, opiates for me do not put me to sleep. They give me energy. They improve my focus. They give me a euphoric feeling. They improve my motivation. I mean, just like everything positive is upregulated and everything negative is eliminated.
Yeah.
But it took 2 years for me to go from that first cough medicine sample to when I was using opiates every day. So it was a very slow progression from experimentation into full-blown addiction where I was using every day to stave off withdrawal symptoms.
You hit so many interesting points there to where the internal experience that you were having of all of these upregulating, it's like, whoa, this is awesome. It, you know, that's not what it says on the package that's supposed to happen, right? And from the outside looking in, you know, it's like, you don't look like you're very motivated. You know, you can't even reach the TV remote, you know, when it gets to a certain point. That's the joke we used to make at the house.
Yeah.
And But that internal experience is what's powering the whole thing. And wow, you just nailed it for people who don't have any experience, and you can stay that way, with the opiates. Because, yeah, from the outside looking in, it's like, why would I want to look like that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, drug of choice. That's why that exists, you know?
So where did the proverbial shit hit the fan and all, and this wonderful ride take a turn?
So in 2019, essentially my partners became aware of what I was doing, that I was an opiate addict, and I was using daily and continuing to work, obviously. And so when they found out, they brought me into the office and fired me right off the bat. I mean, there really weren't even any questions. They just let me go immediately. And so 2 weeks after that, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, investigated me because I was a physician, and thankfully I was cleared of anything from them. But, you know, that was a unpleasant experience, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
But it was another year until I went to rehab, because this is when COVID hits.
Oh.
So COVID hit about a little less than a year after I was terminated from my job. And so the isolation of not working, coupled with the isolation of COVID, and it wasn't a good environment to get sober on your own. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
So I went to rehab in July of 2020 and stayed there for 90 days. And that's kind of my story. I think it was a wonderful experience. You know, I didn't have fun per se, but I appreciated that's what I needed. I appreciated from the very beginning, thankfully, that I needed help to beat this addiction. So I kind of jumped in into the rehab culture with both feet and, you know, learned a lot about myself.
My experience being the person facilitating groups in those treatment centers is that there's often a wonderful culture of group mind. And sure, there's a little bickering and people are going to like people and dislike people. But there's stereotypes that generally hold true. That's why they're a stereotype. And the thing about physicians that I've noticed, and you please tell me, is this idea of secrecy and this idea of shame that cooked into my profession is the belief that I should have known better. I should have seen this. I should have. I'm supposed to. And so the weight that I see in these particular centers that are higher end, and even though it's the same exact kind of weight that maybe the CEO or the housewife, or, you know, I'm making stereotypes, it's the same weight that the others are carrying, but there's this particular flavor that comes with the profession. And I'm wondering if that was your experience, or working in with physicians now, do you see that pretty commonly?
Yes. I mean, there are a number of factors that prevent doctors from getting help. And a big one is that we are afraid that the medical board is going to find out and deem us unfit to practice. So that's one of the bigger reasons why we don't want to tell anyone. And we certainly don't want to go to rehab, or go to somewhere where it can be objective evidence that we have a mental health problem, in fear of losing our job and basically our entire way of life, because that's what the job is for most physicians. And then, yeah, I felt like there was an extra layer of shame because, like you said, I should have known better. I'm a doctor. This is what I do for a living, is make people well. And how did I let myself gets sucked into this, especially knowing the science behind it and whatnot. So that was certainly another layer of, in terms of obstacles getting help. And another one, and this isn't really talked about very, very much, but, you know, the reality is people don't want to hear it from doctors. They don't want to hear doctors complain. Because they don't, because no one really cares, because everyone assumes doctors are rich and happy and are swimming in money and they've got everything made. So the last thing people care about is listening to doctors complain about something. And they don't want to hear about their problems. So that's yet another layer and another obstacle of getting help, the embarrassment of it. Wow. And so, yeah, very, very, doctors are not first in line to ask for help. Let's put it that way. And I felt all of that.
That's a powerful insight and experience on your part. And I never really even thought of that way. It has that connotation of the doctor is supposed to be taking care of the other. And so it's like, yeah, who am I to complain? You know, I've been to, wow. Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, being able to contrast the experience of being treated for cancer and being treated for addiction, because they're both potentially terminal diseases. And, you know, when I was diagnosed with cancer, you know, we were getting mail every day about family and friends. I was getting put on prayer lists at different churches, and people that I didn't even know were sending gifts and flowers, and you know, just the support was unbelievable from family, friends, and strangers too, people in the community. And it's the exact opposite with, I mean, the polar opposite with addiction. And that's unfortunate, because all of that support was very helpful when it came to battling cancer. And, you know, it's just something that's not there. Or at least I'll just speak for myself. It wasn't there when it came to battling addiction.
Wow. Completely get it. And I want to do my best to articulate, you know, well, what is that thing? And this is going to get, you know, into the unscientific, and how do I nail that? Support's a great word, yet there's a particular kind of love, energy, give and take. When you have, let's go for the cancer, there's a connection and a cycle. There's a give and take. There's these people sending love, you receiving love, feeling thankful, and then you take that energy and support, and then you bring it to your healing. The flip side of that is you're not getting, hello, I'd like some, and what then do you take to your healing? It's like, wow, that's a lonely road to hoe. How do you then, I'll take a little shift here now, and you can do this bridge however you like, to where you're helping doctors in this exact position right now in your current coaching business. Is that the best way of saying it?
Yep, that's the best way of saying it. For the listeners that don't know, I coach physicians who are experiencing burnout, and which does include substance abuse a lot of the times, not all the time, but a lot of the time. So, yeah, that's what I do. That's what I do now. I've retired from clinical medicine.
I'm so curious about that. How? Because I don't see a lot of specialties for that. Which is great. You know, you've got a niche, as they say nowadays. How is it received? Do you have to bridge or get around the secrecy thing? Or by calling it burnout, is that an easier way to get people through the door to admit?
Well, yeah, calling it burnout is an easier way to get through the door. And calling me a coach is an easier way to get them through a door, as opposed to counselor or doctor or therapist. For some reason, the semantics of going, is having a coach these days is kind of the cool thing to have. You know, there's coaches for weight loss. There's coaches for diet and exercise. There's trainers. There's coaches for, you know, if you're going through a divorce, there's relationship coach. Everyone has a coach, you know, that's kind of the cool thing. And so for some reason, people who would never get caught dead going to a therapist have no problem going to a coach. And they are different. There are differences between coaching and therapy. But I've always kind of been somewhat amused by that.
It is amazing, isn't it? Well, you're a coach and you've got that MD. So it's just like, there's all kinds of coaches, like you just said. And at the same time, when we get a coach, we're looking for some kind of training or initials after the name to really bump up the what we're hoping to receive. So yeah, you kind of got that going on. How do they find you? I mean, I'm a burnout specialist. I imagine you already have connections in the field, but how does that work?
Well, you know, it's all done via Zoom. So I don't have a brick and mortar office. I work from home, so I can treat anyone anywhere in the world. And the simple answer is word of mouth, social media, a little bit, but it's mostly word of mouth. Doctors speak to other doctors. So if you help, all you need is one. After you've treated one person and they're happy with what you did for them, your name slowly, very, very slowly at first, but it eventually trickles out into the community. And so, yeah, word of mouth. And then I have a website. That's essentially it.
Look at that. Poof. That's essentially it. Just that word of mouth. They're good. Organic reach, as they say. I'm going to, because I'm still stuck on that idea of, you know, how much support you got during the Hodgkin's and then how much you didn't get. And I'm still going to work articulating what was that was gotten and what was not besides support and trying to turn that into different words. But I'd like to take your opinion on this. Burnout. Man, I don't want to even go into the system of things. It's like when I think about it, it's like, wait, ear, nose, and throat, and surgery. And I'm not saying you did this, but it's like in my mind, right, as a patient, and, you know, I was a cokehead. So thank God I got my nose fixed. God bless surgery. He say we're one of the worst noses he's ever seen. It's like fantastic. I can breathe. It's wonderful. But the fear in my mind is if this guy's working back-to-back shifts, I don't want to be the last guy on the docket, you know? It's like I want him just woken up, got his cup of coffee right there. So not going into the system. And the idea of burnout. The idea of the new medicine coming forward and our ideas of AI coming into the system and, you know, these things I've heard is like, well, you know, the doctor's even going to be phased out where, you know, nurses and just get the test and then the diagnosis is gone through the algorithm and then the doctor signs the iPad and you don't even really need to see him and then you go pick up your prescription or treatment of choice. That really removes what I would believe is the basic reasons why a lot of people went into medicine, which is I want to help people. And that help, for me, goes beyond science. And this is that idea of connection with person that I'm trying to get at. There's something gotten when the patient looks me in the eye and says, thank you. And they're not thanking me for all the schooling, they're thanking me for all the schooling and all the things I did right and I followed the rules and they got results, but they're also thanking me for something else. They're thanking me for being a human, for listening to them, for helping them, the reason why I went into the business, right? So I'm curious, here's the question, how much of the burnout and then your maybe even personal story of using of why things got bored was taken out of the system that maybe you recognize, maybe you didn't recognize that this wasn't happening, that this recognition of human-to-human contact was not, maybe is not, and then you see it for the future happening.
Well, so there's two, there's several causes of burnout, but the two that are related to this question is, one is the electronic medical record. And so that's going to be phased into AI essentially. But, you know, the electronic medical record came about 20 years ago. And this is to replace writing on paper, writing your notes on paper. Paper charting is what it's called. And so from a practical standpoint, patients don't like to be talking to a doctor who's got their face buried in a computer.
Right,
not even looking at them. So right off the bat, there's a lack of connection, just from a logistical standpoint of, hey, I gotta type everything in here when I'm seeing this patient. So the electronic medical record, that's one problem. Another problem is insurance companies, third party payer, who are getting in the middle of the doctor-patient relationship. And not just the science and not just the medicine, but also the human contact, like you say. They're getting in between that relationship. And it's really to really pinpoint why doctors do what we do. It all centers around the doctor-patient relationship, fostering that relationship. So when that relationship is compromised, especially when it's compromised by more than one thing at the same time, burnout comes because this is not something we signed up for.
Yeah.
Essentially. So, yeah. And burnout can happen in any profession. Burnout can happen to, you know, moms, dads get burned out, kids get burned out from school, and, you know, lots of varieties of it.
And thank you for that. And I'm also going back to that idea of when things were at its peak, they were rolling for you. You had 5 years of practice, but I was bored. And like you said, people don't want to hear doctors say that, right? It's the reality, though, of it. And when you've reached kind of that top of the ladder kind of situation, and you kind of go around and go, I thought there was more. From this perspective now, from this new position now, position physically and awareness-wise, from that top of the ladder 5 years into practice to where you are now, how are you receiving differently than what happened back then that you were bored?
Right. Well, to answer that question, what I was, and of course I didn't figure this out until a couple years later, but what I was really feeling was a lack of fulfillment as opposed to boredom per se.
Right.
And so that's really, it goes to the heart of burnout is a lack of fulfillment. And so that's treated in your head. You know, that all comes from our thoughts. That all comes from the kind of theory that our thoughts control our emotions and our feelings, and then our emotions and our feelings control our actions, which control circumstances and consequences and whatnot. So it's all about different perspectives. Yeah.
I would imagine that your ability and your experience of being a doctor, a successful doctor, really goes a long way with your patients, clients who can speak that same language and understand what you're going through, what you've gone through, so that they feel like the opposite of what you just explained of the medical records. Oh, wait a minute. This is how it's supposed to be.
Right. And, you know, if I kind of equate it to AA, you know, I've always thought, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's this almost illogically powerful reality of finding other people that have experienced what you've always assumed no one else goes through, you know? And there's a similar connection with physicians and healthcare workers and burnout in that. It's a very comforting feeling to be sitting across from someone who's basically lived through what you're currently struggling with and came out the other side okay.
Indeed. And let me continue that one with, if I'm going to put myself in the role of your client as a doctor coming to you, and I feel this affinity, I feel this connection. It's like, oh, we have a shorthand in language. You know, we get our same little jokes kind of thing. So immediately we're halfway done. And then at some point, I'm going to go, oh, crap. He's saying all the right things. Yeah, I have to do this work for my past and I have to shift my thinking. Okay, I got that. But how do I get from where I'm sitting to where he's sitting? I don't want to be a coach. I want to go back to my job. How do I go back? Sure, it's easy for you now. You had your bridge burned. I want to go back. How do you navigate that with somebody who wants to go back to that, you know, to the burnout situation, which would be equated to, in recovery talk, you know, the slippery people, places, and things? How are you going to do that?
Well, fortunately, I am able to connect with them on that level too, because I did go back. I just had fallen out of love with it. So after rehab and after a couple of years of being out of practice, I did go back to practice. And, but I learned that I had kind of lost my passion for it. And again, that's because of electronic medical record and third party payer. And, you know, there were several reasons, but I liked it fine. I just didn't love it the way I did. And I'll speak for myself. I can't do something like practice medicine and perform surgery if I don't love what I'm doing. You know, that's not the sort of thing that I can will myself to do every day. And so, again, it's just about changing perspective, because what I teach and the theory that I coach from is that it's circumstances don't cause our emotions. You know, circumstances don't cause depression, anxiety, frustration, anger. It's how we interpret different circumstances. So it's everything is done inside the head and shifting. And sometimes it's very slight, just slight little perspective changes is enough. You know, multiply that times, you know, hundreds every day. And you just begin to interpret the same stuff. We're not changing the circumstances. We're not changing the third party payer. We're not changing unappreciative patients. All that stuff remains the same. We're just changing how we interpret that and how that makes us feel about ourselves. And that's it. It's not kind of like recovery from addiction and alcoholism. It's easy, but it's simple, but it's not easy.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Ain't that the truth? I'm going to throw a curveball because I love everything you're saying, and it makes so much sense, and I'm enviable of your ability to talk terms that majority of people nowadays would respect and feel an affinity for and be like, wow, okay, that makes sense. For me, the sense is the head. So the curveball is that interpretation, that change of interpretation. Do you bring in spirituality at all in any way? And you could talk about it as little or as much, because that is definitely not something that is brought into the electronic medical records. And so kind of curious, in your private sessions, is this something that doctors admit to or talk about, or, you know, because there is such a secrecy thing that I've noticed that doctors a lot of times would say, I've had to put that behind me. There's no room for that in the doctor-patient relationship when I'm trying to bang out this medical record and give this person a surgery. Curious as to your thoughts on that.
Well, I can just say pretty simply that no, spirituality is not something that I generally talk about with my clients. Now, if they bring it up, because, you know, my recovery is you know, it's kind of a hybrid between Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step program, which I do in addition to, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that. So I have kind of a mix of spirituality and science with my recovery. So I feel comfortable discussing higher power spirituality with clients. It's just that they rarely bring it up. And I don't like to be the one that brings it up, because I figured if it's an important part of their lives, then I'll figure that out and they'll bring it up at some point. But generally, no, it's, unfortunately, spirituality is not part of the coaching algorithm.
I like your chuckle with that. This was one of those things, you know, right in the very beginning, you were talking about language and the language we use, and you have to find the right one. I would go to several different treatment centers a day and do groups, and I'd have to remember what treatment center rules. I'm allowed to say this language there, I'm allowed to say this language here, and as a doctor of Chinese medicine, I can't say any of that stuff over here. And it really is something, which is why I do appreciate your ability to deliver your messages in a way that is so clear. And I would imagine that your clients definitely appreciate that, because it seems to be that cognitive interpretation. Oh, A plus B equals C. I can do it. It's simple, but not easy. Okay, now what? What's the next step? You know, it has that feel to it. So thank you for what you do. And what would be, I know you talked about the way people find you through word of mouth. What would you say to somebody who is looking for somebody like you? But like I said, and I'm sure you know, it's not like you're going to be listed right there. How does somebody find somebody like you who's in that position that needs your help?
They Google burnout treatment. That's how it happens. I mean, seriously, if you're a physician and you know that you're usually, by the time that you're starting to think to yourself, wow, I think I might be burned out, the answer is you've been burned out for a long time. And so when people start looking, again, you're right, there are precious few resources for physicians in that predicament. And so it's really the internet and my website and Googling, I'm a physician and I'm burned out and I need help. And, you know, the Google takes care of the rest. But my website is theburnoutdoc.com. And there are only a handful of private, you know, physicians who are doing this kind of work. So hopefully it's going to grow. The field is going to grow, because burnout is a rampant epidemic problem, and it's going to get worse before it gets better, certainly.
Well, I love that. And great name for the website. That should help. The Burnout Doc. I'm going to keep reading that, and I will put it in the notes.
And I'm on Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn and all that stuff too. So if you're looking, you can find me.
There you go. Closing thoughts. I want to respect your time. I really appreciate your explanation of all of this. And, you know, burnout, I never even thought about this till talking with you just now, is like, do doctors have as much problem admitting? Do they keep the burnout a secret as much as you would say they maybe there's not as much shame, but, you know, there's still that supposed to. This is the system. This is the way it is. Is it still as hard to admit that I'm getting burned out?
Yes, it is hard. There's a lot of guilt involved with it because you've spent your entire life training for this. A lot of physicians feel like they were called to this line of work. So there's a lot of guilt involved when you start thinking, I don't want to do this anymore. Run into that quite a bit.
Do doctors, a rough percentage, most, little, whatever you think off the top of your head. So the people that come to you, do they go back right into the system they came out of? What's the percentage that make a life change that is significantly different work-wise?
Oh, it's low. Yeah, the whole goal is to get them back working. I would say it's rare that someone, through coaching and through managing their symptoms of burnout, they come to the decision that they want to change careers. No, that doesn't happen very often. Yeah, we want them to go back to work. We need doctors. We don't need to be diluting the field. There's a doctor shortage anyway.
Right. I was just curious as to whether it's like, you know what? You're right. I went into this for the wrong reasons. The idea of love as a child, I did it because of my dad, you know, or whatever. Well, that's actually good then. That's awesome. The idea then that they go back, what tools besides an interpretation change, like besides the mental, are there, what would be another big area of life that they have to address, stereotypically speaking, you know, exercise, or is there any other part that you work with that you notice is missing? Like, you know, you got a iron deficiency. You got to plug that in there.
Well, you know, diet and exercise, it's things that would apply to everyone. So if you're having trouble in your marriage, you need to see someone who does that for a living, a marriage counselor. If you have clinically relevant anxiety or depression, you need to see a psychiatrist. If you're having money difficulty, you need to see a financial advisor. So those are the type. I do not get into the weeds about that stuff. I know what I can do and I know what I cannot do. I'm pretty clear on that. And I don't have any business getting into the fields that I'm not an expert in. I'm a resource for them to be able to say, it sounds like you and your wife or whatnot, you and your husband could benefit from marriage counseling or something like that. If that's the kind of thing you're asking about.
Yeah. And I find that clarity of just that separation between what can be helped and what can't be helped. It's like, oh, I need another specialty with a specialist with that, with finances or marriage. Like, oh yeah, I didn't even think of that. And what it does is it makes what you do with them even clearer and more profound. Simple, but not easy. Dr. Brett, I really want to thank you for your time and your clarity with me today. I learned a lot. Is there anything you'd like to add I missed or want to talk about before we go?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And they can find you at, once again?
TheBurnoutDoc.com.
And that will be in the show notes. Dr. Brett, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate your time. All the best with what you do.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Sober Shaman Podcast, where we explore ways to make the spiritual practical. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Send me any questions or comments you have. Check out the website, randalllyons.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, blessings.